I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. For most Americans, Nepal has long been regarded as a favorite destination, known as a place that's distant and postcard beautiful, a great place to hang out, eat cheap, and enjoy another culture. But there's not much enjoyable about life in Nepal these days, either for travelers or for Nepalis. The country has just emerged from a three-month-long state of emergency put into effect by the king after he disbanded parliament and sacked the prime minister. And what happens next in Nepal has implications that go far beyond its next write-up in The Lonely Planet. Britain, India, and the United States have supplied weaponry to the king in his fight against thousands of Maoist rebels who now control nearly all the countryside outside the capital, Kathmandu. But the fight between the Nepali army and the Maoists shows no sign of stopping. So what's ahead? Is the instability in Nepal a threat to the rest of South Asia? Should other countries, like the U.S., be doing more to help defeat the Maoists or pressure the monarch to bring democracy to the nation? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, the American writer Eliza Griswold. She's joining us from a studio in New York City. Her feature on Nepal is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called It's Not Easy Here in Kathmandu. Eliza, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kunda Dixit is joining us from Kathmandu, Nepal. He is the editor of Nepali Times, and he's been on the program before, so it's nice to welcome you back, Kunda.
Hi.
I'm going to start with you if I can. I know it's late in the evening there, but if I was in Kathmandu today, would I see people going to work, going about their business, or are there still soldiers on the street there?
Well, I think you'd find things absolutely normal. I just flew in today from Malaysia, and the flight was full. There are lots of tourists on board. The city itself has never seemed calmer. In fact, even the checkpoints, the military checkpoints that used to be around the city have disappeared. So the capital itself has always been a bubble, but it's even more so now. But having said that, it's not the same case for the rest of the country, especially the southern part of Nepal along the Indian border. There, things are pretty bad. There's been a major skirmish two nights ago in central east Nepal, in which 35 Maoists were killed in a gun battle. So things are pretty tense outside. But having said that, the trekking areas and the mountain areas are still safe. In fact, this is the time to come to Nepal because there are no tourists here.
So the people who were put in jail, the activists, the politicians, have they all been released?
Not all. There's been a very slow pace of release of some of the political party leaders. Some get arrested and others get taken in. Student leaders have been taken in today. The former prime minister is still in jail and his custody has been remanded for another 5 days. So there's still quite a few people in jail or in house arrest, but the senior leaders who were arrested on February 1st, they are now out.
So I'm a little bit confused here, and I need you to help me. When you say that everything looks fine in Kathmandu, are you saying that it's a kind of Potemkin happiness in the capital city, that there's more going on underneath the surface?
No, well, actually, no. It is quite normal. There has never been that much violence here anyway in the capital. The demonstrations which take place are sudden, and then the police swoop in and they take away a dozen or so students. And, you know, most people don't even see it because it's in the back alleys. Mm-hmm. So it's you get a sense that things are absolutely normal. But, of course, if you take the whole country, then they're not.
Let me turn to Eliza Griswold here, because Eliza, when you took this assignment, I understand that you took with you sort of expectations that it would be a pretty easy gig telling the story of Nepal.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And I'd just like to echo what Kunda's saying in terms of the tourism. This is a good time to go to Nepal. I mean, they're absolutely in the Terai along the area of the Indian border that Kunda's talking about, where I spent most of the time, which is not particularly a tourist area, which is hotly contested between the Maoists and the government forces. That area is particularly violent. But the violence doesn't affect trekkers, and it doesn't affect tourists, and I think it's really important to understand that.
Is that why people tend to concentrate more on Nepal as a pleasurable destination than talk about it as a war zone?
Well, I mean, the bubble that one's talking about, that Kunda is mentioning in particular, you know, tourists have long not seen the realities of much of rural Nepal. Basically, Nepal functions as two countries. You have what's within the capital, what's within the Kathmandu Valley, and all that lies beyond, where development very rarely reaches, and development meaning medical care, schools, roads in particular, and that's where the Maoists hold sway.
Kunda, back to you on this, if I can ask you to help us see this through Nepali eyes. Are the people there in support of the king when he disbands parliament and shuts down the radio stations and sends soldiers into the newspaper offices?
Well, when he did that on February 1st, this is more than 3 months ago, people weren't coming out on the streets, you know, in protest or expressing their outrage. There was, in fact, almost muted support. Mainly because people were desperate, they were sick of the violence and the conflict, and they really wanted to believe that the king could set things right. But I think that support is time-bound, and it's limited for a limited period only, and they have to see improvement in the situation for that support to continue. So far, it doesn't look like the people have given up on the king yet. The opposition to the king's move has been from the political parties, from the intellectual class, from journalists like us. But being journalists, we have to also report that there is this almost a desperate clutching at the straws with the king's move. And what we've seen in the 3 months, though, is that we haven't seen a major improvement in the security situation in the rest of the country, although Kathmandu looks more normal. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the people's patience may run thin after a while.
Am I right in sort of doodling three little boxes on a piece of paper here saying that there are those who support the king, there are those who support the opposition parliamentarians, and there are those who support the Maoists?
Yeah, I think you're more or less right. The support for the Maoists is mainly restricted to their strongholds, which is the midwestern part of Nepal and wherever they've have more of a predominant position. Elsewhere, the support seems to come more because there's really no other way out. It's from the barrel of the gun. So that support must also be qualified. And I think the triangle you mentioned is also the triangle of the political parties, the king, and the Maoists, and it's a struggle for power between these three forces.
Eliza, in your own reporting, did you get a chance to talk to the people with different levels of support, people who are looking for change and wondering where it's going to come from?
Absolutely. I'd say most strikingly that was in the Terai, in this area in which no one firmly holds sway, not the government forces, which, just to underscore, is called the Royal Nepali Army. That's a king's army. Basically, until a couple of years ago, a palace guard akin to Buckingham Palaces. So in the area in which neither the army holds sway nor the Maoists, and it's really the people who get caught in the middle with perpetual, I mean, if you think kind of Cambodia, you're thinking of people coming in, government forces coming in, and they have no idea who the Maoists are and who they aren't. So massacres frequently entail killing farmers or killing whoever gets in the middle.
And the Maoists are accused of doing the same thing. Is that a legitimate accusation?
Absolutely. I mean, in most places where I was, people were free enough to talk a little bit because they weren't just firmly under Maoist sway. And they really spoke of large degrees of dissatisfaction with the Maoists, extortion, and probably most egregious is the policy of forced recruitment, which is, you know, goes against one of Mao's principal tenets, which is don't make people, you know, fight for you. And the Maoists are now conscripting at least one person from many families. And that actually, in my experience, direct reporting, that's what people most strongly objected to and turned them against the Maoists.
Kunda, just one more for you, if you can help us with this. How much pressure is there on you now as a newspaper editor to, be very careful with your stories? Can you write whatever you want, or are you operating even now under restrictions?
Well, the restrictions are still in force. You know, there was a very draconian regulation made on February 6th during the first week after the royal takeover, which had very broad, strict punishment for unspecified transgressions, like, you know, things like reducing the morale of the security forces or going against the spirit of the royal proclamation, with punishment like confiscation of assets and things like that. Now, that's a sword still hanging over our heads. Although, having said that, the very direct censorship that took place in the first 2 weeks after February 1st, which, you know, soldiers in the newsroom, people that we called editors-in-chief, you know, that's all stopped now. But the censorship is now more self-censorship because you have this this very strict regulation. And on top of that, journalists are being harassed. They're being summoned to the police or the civil administrator to answer questions. And I must say that here in Kathmandu, the journalists are not that vulnerable. It is the radio journalists and the Nepali language journalists in the districts who are most exposed to pressure.
I need to stop you there because we're at the end of our segment. So, Kunda, I thank you very much for being with us.
Bye-bye.
Kunda Dixit is editor of Nepali Times, joining us there on the line from Kathmandu. More after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about what's going on in Nepal. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Certainly, 3 months ago, when a state of emergency was imposed, it was a dramatically different place. The state of emergency has only just recently been lifted. The Indians, for example, have said that they will resume their arms sales to the king in Kathmandu. The U.S. never did stop their arms sales. It is a country that relies significantly on foreign aid. So that's one way of taking a look at what's going on in Nepal. As long as it is accepting aid from Britain and from India and from the United States, should these countries be doing more to either help control the Maoist rebels or to put pressure on the parliamentarians and the king to put in place something that looks a little bit more like democracy in Nepal? 1-800-423-8255. I'm going to bring Anup Pahari into the conversation now. He teaches Nepali language and culture at the Foreign Service Institute, part of the State Department, is former president of the American-Nepal Society in Washington, and he's been listening along, joins us from a studio there. Anup, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dick, for this opportunity.
Can I ask you, in your view, what's changed? I was in India back in 96 when the Maoists first popped their heads up, and they seemed almost like cartoons. You know, I remember people thinking, Maoists? What are Maoists doing? And they had old rifles, and people thought that they didn't really amount to much. But so much seems to have changed in the last 10 years.
There is this cartoonish, surreal sense of what's happening in Nepal, and certainly a very dedicated and serious Maoist armed insurgency in the 1990s is an outlandish idea. But if you know Nepal and Nepali political history, Nepal has been sort of insulated and isolated from the winds of the ideas and issues that have traversed the Indian continent. You know, India went through many years of ferment before it settled down into a stable parliamentary democracy. But in Nepal, you know, democracy was an on-again, off-again sort of affair. There was a constant struggle between the monarchy and the intelligentsia organized into political parties, who gradually began to amass more support in the rural areas. And finally, things came to a head in the 1980s. And finally, towards the end of the 80s, a concerted and unified, you know, political party movement for democracy pushed the former king, King Birendra, to accepting multi-party democracy, accepting sovereignty of the people.
And people thought in 1990 that that was going to take hold.
And it did. You know, I think for a number of years, the Nepali democracy, you know, was, you know, I mean, for the movement itself, for example, was different than in the past because the parties finally came together on a common agenda to oppose the king and to draft a constitution in which the people were sovereign. Mm-hmm. So the Nepali constitution of 1991 is a significant landmark political achievement in Nepal's history because for the first time it brought about a constitutional monarchy with sovereignty vested in the people. Right? So what happened after 1990, and that brings us to the Maoist insurgency, of course, is a separate issue. But in the initial periods of the democracy, there was a lot of back and forth, there was a lot of tentativeness. But at the same time, one has to keep in mind that although it didn't look wonderful and fully formed, you know, at the moment of its birth, I think one of the things that the Nepali democracy did do and do well was that it created this environment of openness throughout the whole country, where people with their different views, ideas, issues, could vet it out in open air. And, you know, the Maoist insurgency and the Maoists themselves are a product of this openness that came about after 1990, the fact that they could move around, the fact that they could organize cultural shows. And this is before they took up arms, you know, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were openly going around the rural countryside in Nepal under the protection of a democratic constitution in which you could air your views. And so, yes, the democracy didn't take off and produce the kinds of results that were promised by the parliamentarians and politicians immediately. But in terms of creating an open environment where people could talk, speak, you know, participate in NGOs, elect their local governments, and so on and so forth, I think it had made a very good start.
Let me, Eliza, turn back to you on what you heard from the people in terms of why they support the Maoists. Is it, in fact, a failure of the government in Kathmandu to provide any services, anything for the people that has them turning to the Maoists as a sort of weird alternate form of government?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I think we think of a Maoist rebellion, you know, now as an anachronism, but far more anachronistic is the idea of, you know, an absolute monarchy in Nepal today. And I think with the failure of democracy, I think for lots of people living in the countryside, initially, there was the presence of, you know, roads. The Maoists delivered on infrastructure demands that were the first, they really were the first presence of
any. So they built roads?
They did. Initially, they did build roads, and they provided some infrastructure where the state never had before. But now I really think that support for the Maoists has waned to the point that they really are experienced much more like a group of thugs. They rule by fear in most of the countryside.
Well, they're the closest model that I keep coming across is that they liken themselves, and quite publicly, to the Shining Path, which is, rather than being a sort of peasant-based revolution, is one that, in fact, exploits that fear quite openly. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, that's absolutely accurate.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation as we try to figure out what's going on in Nepal, how that country's changing, and what difference it will make, both in South Asia, but also in the way that other countries deal with Nepal. We're going to Boston. Bose is joining us on the line. Hi, Bose.
Hi. Hi, my name is Bose.
Yeah. Go ahead.
How are you today? Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I actually grew up outside of Nepal and in a small town which is called Itahari. And my thing is, people in there are fear among the people inside to talk about anything but and everything. Like if I went to my home and my family would say to me that do not talk about anything related to politics because we are a neutral person. And I think there is no fear. If you talk about Maoist, there is a fear that probably people from the government would snack you up. Or if you talk about government and if you support the pro-government, people who are affiliated with Maoist, maybe they would affect you in some way. So basically, literally, people are, if you are not taking any sides, it's better off keeping quiet and listening to people. That's the situation in Nepal right now.
I'm wondering, Bose, did you leave the country to come and be a student in the United States, or have you left the country, not sure when you'll go back?
No, actually, I was a student for 4 years.
But stayed on after that period of time?
Yeah, I'm here working.
I tell you why I'm asking the question, because when I'm looking at what's changing in Nepal, I often see that they're one of the effects of this fight between a government that's not popular and the Maoists who are not that popular is that a lot of the bright people are leaving the country.
Yes, there is a flock of people who if you talk to the next person, the willingness of to go outside of the country is very, it's overwhelming, and I think it's the whole process is brand in. Like Nepal, I think, lacks a leader who has education and who are into education. There are very few leaders who are educated, and that's the whole problem for democracy was.
Anup Bihari, does that conform with how you see the country today?
Yeah, I mean, this problem of people flooding out of the country is actually not restricted to the educated. I mean, the educated in small numbers have trickled out of the country starting in the 1960s and, you know, became a bigger trickle, you know, a stream in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. At the moment, Nepal's economy is sustained on remittance earnings. And there are over 1.5 million Nepalese, most of very rural and modest means, who have seen absolutely no future in the Nepali economy to sustain an ordinary household at ordinary living levels. So where are they going? There are over 500,000 Nepalese in the Middle East alone, probably more. They're, you know, in Malaysia, in Southeast Asia. There are millions of Nepalese displaced over the 10 years in India, earning and sending revenue back home. And that is how Nepali economy is sustained. In fact, even through the conflict, Nepal's foreign reserves are actually quite good, and that can be attributed to this huge infusion of remittances from abroad.
And let me interrupt you for half a second. I want to go back to Bose. Bose, you're still there on the line?
Yeah.
What would it take for you to go back to Nepal? What would have to change there?
People, like a pool of our friends who really talk about this all the time, and they think that we are afraid because we couldn't start anything. We have a plan. We want to start something, but there is no peace at all.
Start some business.
Start some business, some projects. In fact, my friend is actually starting a non-profit organization which is called Nepalese Children Education Fund. We are actually trying to educate poor people in Nepal, and we are trying to take outside of Kathmandu, and it's getting hard because of peace, I think.
All right, Bose, thanks for your call. Eliza, what did you hear from people while you were traveling there? A desire to leave the country or what?
Well, I think that this is really, I think this is one of the most important issues for us to understand today about Nepal, is this mass migration. And particularly last fall, when 11 or 12 Nepalis were killed in Iraq, there was widespread rioting in Kathmandu, which is rare. And the riots really attacked the manpower agencies, which are the intermediaries who send people abroad. And these guys who were killed were seen as economic martyrs because there's a very – it's a palpable feeling on the ground that people – that the country is sustained by people who leave, that the economy would collapse without them. So it's more inevitable than desire. I mean, especially when you look at, you know, the sex trade and the number of women going particularly to India – it's really frightening.
I'm wondering, Eliza, in thinking back on your trip and how this country still tends to regard Nepal, if you've come up with a way of saying why the circumstances in Nepal should really matter to people who are listening to our conversation, people who are living in this country? Is it just another sort of bumpy South Asian country that can't seem to get its political act together? Or is this a bigger issue that requires people to focus on it?
That's a good question. I mean, as a journalist, you know, why does this matter to us is clearly foremost in my mind a lot, and articulating that to people besides, you know, a human rights situation, which is really horrific. Mm-hmm. We could say security. I mean, there are lots of reasons. You know, there are definitely jihadis going to Kashmir using, you know, a destabled Nepal as a way to get through the country. You can look at the possible presence of terrorists in any failed state. But more than security, what we're looking at, you know, is a group of people who want change and are ready for change. And we, the U.S., has the real ability to affect change without too much intervention. So why should we care? Because
do you mean by selling more? No. You'll get no quarrel from me on that one. But do you mean that by selling more arms, selling fewer arms, by putting the go ahead.
Well, one thing is, I mean, in terms of selling arms, it's rare that the U.S. gives. We had, while I was there, there was an order for 20,000 AK-47s. I think about 5 had been delivered. Nobody was quite sure how many thousand had been delivered. What's rare about Nepal is that we rarely give. I mean, the Royal Nepali Army, according to the leading human rights organization on the ground, a group called INSEC, tortures 80% of the people who end up in its custody. That's a pretty high number, especially for us to be giving, the U.S. to be giving, unchecked military aid. Now, we have said in Congress that we are going to put some checks on that funding. But with Christine Rocha's recent visit, she just said we're going to take military aid under advisement. It would be very, very easy for us to put some conditions on that aid that were quite clear. And the Nepalese would respond to that. The king absolutely would.
Assistant Secretary of State Christine Rocha, Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, was recently just in Nepal meeting with the king and talking about this. That's part of what Eliza is talking about. But Anoop, as former head of the American-Nepal Society, this is something that you clearly spend some time thinking about. How do you make the case to people in the country that this is something that really requires attention?
Well, on an idealistic plane, I think even if America didn't have any interest on Nepal on the ground, which actually they don't, because, you know, we're in the Indian sphere of influence, and most of the relationship that the United States has cultivated with Nepal over the years have been via goodwill things like the Peace Corps, mountaineering expeditions, and so on and so forth. So idealistically, I think Americans are a people that wish good for others in the world. They wish to spread democracy and peace. And certainly this president has made no secret of that. So just idealistically, it would be nice for the United States to intervene on a behalf of a very long-suffering and poor people in a very remote part of the world.
But it means coming down between the sides in a way, doesn't it? If you've got the king who will exercise the kind of power that we saw him exercise when he imposed a state of emergency, and the Maoists who don't seem to answer to anyone, then you've got the United States trying to figure out where does it fit in between those two.
Right. But the United States, you know, I'm happy to say, is, you know, the arms issue aside, and that's a very contentious issue. Mm-hmm. You know, India had initially stopped, you know, giving arms for a few weeks after the coup, and then now it's resumed. And that's a very tricky issue because giving arms now gives you some sort of leverage with a regime. Completely not giving arms risks Nepal and Nepal's elites taking Nepal to perhaps something like Burma, totally closed, you know, society. So leaving that aside just for a minute and talking about what the United States has really called for on the ground, it seems to me like a very pragmatic call. I mean, you know, Secretary Donald Camp at a hearing in the United States Congress said very aptly, the constitutional forces of Nepal must hang together, otherwise they're going to hang separately. And I think that's precisely correct. And the United States has come down repeatedly not taking sides between the parties and the king, but instead saying, you know, your 1991 constitution was a good idea. It was a good document. That was a great start to restore democracy and give people their civil rights and so on and so forth. Why don't you go back to that? Find the basis for unity. between the constitutional forces, i.e. the palace and the parties. And they had a good working relationship for at least 6 or 7 years after 1990.
I have to stop you there. We're going to take a short break. A reminder to our listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We are talking this hour about the Maoist rebels and the remarkable amount of Nepal that they control. Eliza Griswold talks about it as two countries. One is Kathmandu and the valley area surrounding that, and the rest of the country, which is in the control of the Maoist rebels. The U.S. in there with arms sales. Your thoughts on what needs to be done. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about what's going on politically and militarily in Nepal as the Maoist rebels tighten their hold on the countryside, and the king and the parliamentarians try to figure out what to do, and other countries looking in over the mountain kingdom try to figure out what their influence can and should be, the U.S. among them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cedar Falls, Iowa, for a call from Bill. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. Tell me what you think.
Well, a couple of things, and I'll preface this by saying that I've traveled to Nepal 5 times over the last 30-odd years. I've done a lot of work with volunteering with NGOs for rural economic and community development. And a couple of things come to mind. One is the need for civil service reform. The change to a constitutional parliamentary system in the early 90s and then the rapid changes of governments really exacerbated the problems with a civil service spoil system. And the exploitation fell hardest on people in rural areas, which in turn created this hotbed for the Maoists to exploit.
Are you saying it's just basically corrupt and the money?
Yeah, there was a high degree of corruption.
Right, and money that's supposed to be going to the rural areas ends up building an addition to the mansion on the mountains outside Kathmandu, or what?
No, it would be that a new governor would be appointed for a district. He would bring in his cohorts, and they would try and extract as much wealth out of the district through fines and fees and all kinds of things, extort it, basically.
Yeah.
Get as much as they could, as quickly as they could, because they expected they would be out in 6 months. So there needs to be an honest and stable civil service. The United States had to go through this back in the 1870s and 80s. We had to do away with the spoil system. Well, this has been a major fomenter of unrest and unhappiness in the rural areas. The second thing I would say is we need to really work with the government of India so that the treaties that it has for international trade with Nepal are honored. Classic case a few years ago, Eastman Kodak wanted to build a photo processing facility in Kathmandu. They invested the money, they built the plant, and then when it came time to transship the goods from Calcutta up to Kathmandu, the photo paper, the chemicals, and so forth, India wouldn't allow it. They capriciously stepped in and said no. The same thing happens with medical supplies and equipment, dental supplies and equipment. Under international law, these are not to be taxed.
Yeah, and this is a recollection. When I listen to Bill, I'm reminded of an attitude in India that Nepal was a sort of misbehaving child to the north, more like a province than a neighboring state.
Yes, this is unfortunately true. I mean, the Nepali state has had, a long-standing, trade relationship with India, which for the most part has worked out to the disadvantage of Nepal, no matter what government was in Kathmandu, whether it was the Rana regime or was the Panchayat regime after that, and even during the democratic period. And that's a serious bottleneck that, any Nepali state needs to tackle with India. And India has this patronizing, hegemonistic attitude towards Nepal. And even on the issue of the insurgency, the Indian state initially was very reluctant to use its resources to aid Nepal at the border, crossings and arms. I mean, most of the Maoist arms and ammunition come from India. India is a huge state with lots of resources, intelligence, so on and so forth. So there's this feeling among Nepali security analysts that in addition to all the unfairness towards Nepal on trade issues, as the caller very accurately pointed out, there's also been this complacency regarding, so the mouse issue. So basically, there is this thesis, and you know, some of it is conspiracy theory. You know, small nations always feel that big nations conspire against them. But I think there is some degree of truth to that. The Indian state wants to micromanage and manage and control the rate of economic growth and development change in Nepal to a point where Nepal's sovereignty may be affected. And I agree with the caller. And I also would like to point out that the caller is absolutely correct in pointing out that governance and delivery of goods depends on a competent civil service. And one of Nepal's greatest misfortunes, especially during the democratic period, was that on the one hand, when people's expectations of what they would be given, what they would receive from a democratic government went up so dramatically, whereas the ability of the state to deliver that in an orderly, predictable, and fair way was never commensurately multiplied.
Although, I mean, one point to make is that we've seen just in the last 10 or 15 years, India address that problem and deal with it in many ways, transforming its own clumsy and civil service into something that is a little bit more efficient, that isn't necessarily linked to each election and, you know, who can get their friends in and who can get the most out of it. I want to go back to our callers here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And to Cambridge, Massachusetts, Sagoon's joining us. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Dick. I just want to make a comment on the Maoist problem that's happening in Nepal.
Yeah.
And basically, arming the government, army is not the solution, you know, like long term, because these people are like who joined the Maoist are from like very low caste and very economically like backwards people. So till we do something about like changing the economic infrastructure in the whole Nepal, not just Kathmandu, let's forget about Kathmandu, and all over the Nepal, you will always have these people, you know.
Okay, but Sagun, this is the great puzzle, if I understand it correctly. The Maoists hold the countryside, and the government is not able, because the Maoists hold the countryside, the government is not able to get in there and deliver any kind of services. So the Maoists can continue to insist that the government is not helping them. How do you break that?
Well, that's the thing. We got to come up, and like government has to come up with start a dialogue between Maoist, like these leaders, like Prachanda and all. And you just have to start somewhere. I mean, you can't just go on and say like, okay, the Maoists are doing this, we can't get in, so the problem is going to just go on, you know.
And Eliza,
Dick, can I add something to this real quick, if I might?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, this is a classic problem faced in an insurgency situation, not only in Nepal, but this was played out in Central America several decades ago. The question is a balance between a carrot and a stick policy. Now, as to the question of what amount of territory the Maoists control, Dick, you mentioned that, you know, they control, vast swaths of the country and so on and so forth. Again, you know, there have been studies that have gone into Nepal interiors and actually tested this question of what amount of territory do they actually control and what does control mean?
Right.
You know, my contention to you would be if about 150, you know, trekkers in Nepal decided to adopt a village and to take up arms and to defend it to the death, most likely the state would be unable to dislodge them for months at a time. You know what I'm saying? It's a country that is territorially very, very difficult. The state was very thinly spread out to begin with, as Alyssa pointed out, and that was one of the beauties of Nepal. It was just communities and communities living together, no state. If there was a state, it was a health post, a couple of police posts, so on and so forth, you know, up the valley, down the valley, into river valleys. You hardly saw a state. Then you came to the district headquarters and you saw some more state. So my contention to you would be that, you know, if 150 tourists can take up a village and control a district, then certainly people who grew up in that village, who grew up in that district, if they are determined enough, the opportunity cost of taking up arms against the Nepali state is not that high. You know, you could go around, you know, wear a red band on your head, you know, chant Mao slogans, go door to door and shake people for money, and you're not paying a very heavy cost for that, except when you get caught up, and you get caught up very infrequently.
Eliza Griswold, you met some of these people. Do you think that under certain circumstances the Maoists would be open to this sort of, maybe we should be talking, maybe that would be in the best interest of the people here?
Well, the Maoists have called for conversation with the king himself, and that is one reason that the king used in establishing the state of emergency was, look, you guys, you know, you Democratic parties have done nothing in establishing a conversation with the Maoists, and they've called to talk to me, and that, in a way, you know, that was incredibly hopeful, and people in Nepal were going to give the king, as Kunda said, they were going to give the king some latitude on that. The question is, how far is that dialogue going? You know, a possibility for dialogue would radically transform, or could radically transform, the situation. One thing, I mean, just to visualize in terms of, like, what do the Maoists control?
Mm-hmm.
If you look, if you think of sort of, you know, a map of Kathmandu, and you think of these district headquarters, these are throughout, they dot the entire country as, like, the government will hold a district headquarters, and it's basically a small fortified city, but less than a city, sort of a fortified village. And then beyond that, sort of a kilometer out from those forts, that's where the Maoists hold control. So it's not as if there are whole entire areas of the country where, you know, the Maoists hold absolute sway. It's more like they're tiny dots on the map where the government holds control, and those are district headquarters. So those are important areas, but beyond that, they hold nothing at all.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Providence, Rhode Island, and Marcia's with us. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. I just came back from Nepal about a month ago. I've been there many times. Our commentators, our speakers, have been talking as if there are two choices: either support the king or the Maoists. But there's a third alternative, and that's where I think the U.S. should put our energy and our focus, and that is supporting the Democratic Center, the parliamentary parties. They have not done very well. They've betrayed many of the ideals that they speak about. But nevertheless, that is where we should be giving our support, to reestablish parliamentary representative democracy, because otherwise there's no way
out. But how do you rebuild the people's respect for the parliamentarians if they're seen as part of the problem, people who, you know, get themselves elected to see what they can get out of the system?
Well, that will be very difficult, but they are beginning to get together. I understand they've just squabbled among themselves, but uh-huh. They've learned their lesson. And we've done this in other countries where we've had institutes that have supported the growth of democracy and representative government. And I think we should be supporting them, helping them, perhaps advising or doing whatever we can to help them to organize themselves and represent a real alternative. They are an alternative.
And Anoop, I think I saw just a couple of days ago that seven of the parties that normally wouldn't have anything to do with each other have said publicly, maybe we need to join forces just to show that we can be a viable alternative to rule by the king. Is that a step in the right direction?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to, you know, commend the caller for pointing out a very perceptive issue here. I regret that, you know, I came across as indicating that there were just two forces in Nepal to choose from. I strongly disagree with that view. And in fact, any view that this is a war just between the Maoists and the king, with the Maoists and the king posing as the two major choices. No, I mean, in fact, there's a very vast middle ground in Nepal. And I'm a strong proponent of this middle ground, in which political parties must be rehabilitated and given the actual responsibility of, you know, conducting a responsible democratic politics of the country. And they're quite capable of doing that. I mean, you know, and the political parties in Nepal, everybody talks about their failure and their failure and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. Yes, there is a certain degree of failure. But I think the failure in Nepal, the crisis in Nepal, must be looked at in the perspective of a major Maoist onslaught on the Nepali state. The Maoists did not attack the king or the king's army or people they didn't like. The Maoists, from day one, wanted to bring down the entire Nepali state infrastructure, in which the constitutional monarchy is a part, but only a part. The other part are elected representatives across the country. And the Maoists have prevented any political party from conducting ordinary meetings, meeting with
right,
citizens.
In part because they see them as a challenge.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to our callers here. We're going next to sure. Boston. D-Base is joining us on the line. D-Base.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Nepal, and you know, we have spent countless hours talking about Nepal over here in Cambridge with, you know, people, you know, from Nepal and people who are interested in Nepal. And
have you got it sorted out, D-Base?
Okay, so one of the things that we, you know, kind of, well, I kind of figured out is, you know, there are three choices that we have: Maoist political parties and the king. And in the long run, I think constitutional monarchy with a parliament, a democratic process, would be the best way to go. And I think I totally agree with the previous caller.
So how do you get from where the country is now to there, and what would it take to get you to go back and be a part of that transformation?
You know, it's given fact that the king or the Maoists, they're not going to win with the barrel of the gun. So negotiation is the only way to go. And, you know, there has to be some kind of international effort in terms of having all these three parties on the table. And, you know,
And if the Indians came in and the America and the American State Department came in and said, look, let's get on with this right now, you think that it might make a difference?
I think so, yes. And the other you know, part of the story is, you know, with economic activities going in China and in India, I think there can be a overflow of those economic activities mm-hmm. that Nepal can benefit. And those are the things that, you know, when China and India, if they want to have a 850-mile-long border without having to spend on the security, you know.
That's the way of getting to it. D-Base, I thank you for your call. Eliza, I want to just turn to you with one part of your conclusion here, and that was that you've covered a lot of conflict. And so in seeing this one, your comment to my colleague here was that this is a very dangerous moment, that this is the time when they either need to address this or they're going to lose it, or it will spin out of control and become a lot more bloody.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And the caller who was pro multi-party democracy, clearly that's the answer. And already, if you talk to our embassy, you know, Ambassador Moriarty is working as effectively as he can with these parties in the idea of building democratic understanding. So that's certainly what our agenda is. I would question how effective it is, since in its wake, the king, you know, took absolute power. But, yeah, no, I think it's incredibly sad, and one of the intractable realities is once you base a conflict so dramatically on abusing the people in the middle, you're going to get an intractable conflict. And that losing the naivete is really one of the most frightening moments I've seen in any conflict anywhere.
Eliza, thank you for being with us on the program. Eliza
thank
Criswell.
You.
Freelance writer, her piece It's Not Easy in Kathmandu in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Anoop Pahari, I thank you for being with us as well.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Anoop teaches Nepali language and culture at the Foreign Service Institute. We talked earlier with Kunda Dixit, editor of the Nepali Times. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.